This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British film producer David Putnam is best known for such films as Chariots of Fire, Midnight Express, The Killing Fields, and Local Hero. For about 18 months in the mid-80s, he headed Columbia Pictures. Now he's produced a new film which he says will be his last. It's called My Life So Far, and it's about a 10-year-old boy whose eccentric family lives on an estate in Scotland. His father is an inventor who some neighbors consider a crackpot. He's the founder of the only moss factory in Europe. The wondrous atmosphere of the estate changes when the boy's uncle brings his beautiful girlfriend for a visit and the boy's father starts to fall in love with her. Here's the boy and his father taking her on a tour.
The moss itself has properties which are one at the same time both antiseptic and therapeutic.
It's 10 times more absorbent than cotton wool.
Mm.
And these women we see here are the cutters and the balers.
Afternoon, Mr. Pettigrew, sir.
Okay, Sir Rick. Brawn, bonny afternoon of it. We're having the new Malassie.
It's an advantage to have a working knowledge of the local vernacular. Well, the cutters and the balers...
The cutters have the job of cutting the moss.
Uh-huh, and the balers have the
balers
job...
Balers have the job of doing the baling.
A considerable quantity of water has to be removed from the moss before it can be racked in the drying shed.
For drying? And we made cigars from the dried moss, didn't we, Dad?
It's not one of our better ideas.
I asked David Putnam why he wanted to produce My Life So Far.
I read the book, which was about the childhood of a man I knew quite well. I read it on a plane, actually, on my way to Tokyo, and by the time I got off the plane in Tokyo, I definitely wanted to make the movie. When I was reading it, I could see it as a film. I think partly because there were a number of pictures that I loved. Cinema Paradiso, My Life as a Dog. There was a type of picture that I enjoyed and never made, if you know what I mean. And I knew I was moving towards the end of my career, and it seemed like one of the nicer ones to go out on.
Now, you asked Hugh Hudson, who also directed Chariots of Fire, which you produced, to direct My Life So Far. Why did you think of him?
Because he's got a beautiful sense of period, which was evident in Chariots. And all of the qualities that the man has are come very naturally to this type of story. So it would have been there was no sense of it being a stretch for him. He comes from that type of world. He understands that type of world. He's got a wonderful sense of landscape, and that was always going to be important for the movie. So it was just good casting.
Now, I've read that this is likely to be your last film. Is that true? Is this your last film?
It's true. It's certainly my last film as a line producer in the way that I've always produced. I might well end up executive producing something in the future, but I doubt it very much.
Why is this your last film?
Because it's incompatible with the life I have and have had for the last 2 years in politics. I now work for the government, and I tried for a while to kind of spin two lots of plates, but I found that they were genuinely incompatible, that I was always dropping one of them.
Have you become disillusioned with filmmaking?
No, not at all. I've done 30 years. I'm 58 years old. The audience is still 24. They were 24 when I started 30 years ago. And I just feel that it's a stretch now. Probably in an ideal world, I would like to have got a couple more movies under my belt, but I think I could always say that. You know, if I was 60 and I'd say, well, maybe there's a couple of scripts I'd still like to do. I've seen too many victims of the motion picture industry who are still trying to make movies or get films made at 70. And what they're trying to do is peddle a script that probably was written 10, 12, 15 years earlier to someone behind a desk who's in their late 20s. And it's not that surprising that there's a kind of culture conflict between them.
Now, you said that your life of politics was not really compatible with your life as a film producer. You were made a life peer in 1997 and took the title of the Lord Putnam of Queensgate. And this means that you're serving in the House of Lords. What does it mean to serve in the House of Lords?
It means you're appointed to the House of Lords for life. It means you are part of the legislature. It's not a million miles away from your Senate. And you specialise in certain areas. I tended to specialise in education and the cultural industries and the media. And you have the right to scrutinise legislation and indeed even to amend legislation. And strangely enough, I'm speaking in the House tonight with a couple of amendments on the bill that's going through to create the London Mayor. So you're part of the legislative process. But more important than that, from my point of view, is I work for the Department of Education, and my responsibility is everything to do with teachers, teacher morale, teacher recruitment, the role of professional working conditions of teachers in the future. And I find it incredibly challenging and interesting job.
Now, Prime Minister Tony Blair, to whom you were an advisor, wants to do away with the House of Lords. How do you feel about that?
No, he doesn't. He wants to do away with the hereditary component of the House of Lords. That is to say that you're in the House of Lords because your father was in the House of Lords. That goes this year. From this year onwards, the House of Lords will be primarily made up of appointed peers, people like me who are life peers, whose peerage ends the day that they pop their socks. Temporarily, there'll be a period where 91 hereditary peers will remain, but they too will go in a couple of years' time.
It seems kind of undemocratic, doesn't it?
What, having appointed peers or life peers?
Well, appointed peers for life.
No, I don't think it's remotely undemocratic, because what modern democracies need is expertise, and it's a way of attracting people with serious expertise into the public sector and offering the public role. For example, take a thing like GM crops or all the areas, in fact, of biotechnology. It's ridiculous to hope that we'll ever have elected members of parliament, or in your case, congressmen, who really understand the issues. That it's just not going to happen. So they will always be at the mercy of their paid officials or lobbyists. One of the things we're not nearly as damaged by, our political process in the UK is not nearly as damaged by the power and influence of lobbyists as yours is. And one of the reasons for that is we have a lot of expertise existing in the House of Lords. Quite difficult for lobbyists to deal with people who are real experts.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lord David Putnam. He's a movie producer, briefly was the head of Columbia Studios. The films he's produced include Chariots of Fire, The Killing Fields, Midnight Express. He's also the author of a recent book called Movies and Money. Now, in your book, Movies and Money, you describe a turning point in your career as a producer after seeing the movie Midnight Express with an audience. Describe the scene and the audience's reaction to the scene that had such an impact on you.
Yeah, it was. We had a tricky transition within the film that we had to deal with, which was to take the hero, or if you can call him a hero, Billy Hayes, from the prison down into what was, to all intents and purposes, an insane asylum.
And this was a Turkish prison. He was arrested for
smuggling drugs. And we needed to make this a kind of seamless transition. What we didn't have is the screen time to explain why this all came about. So we needed an incident. And the incident we opted for was a fight with another prisoner who had goaded him and created a lot of problems for all of them, during which Billy actually bites this guy's tongue out. Now, the idea that was such an aberrant and insane thing to do that you weren't particularly surprised when you saw him walking around in white pyjamas. And we had a lot of discussions, Alan Parker and I, about how to do it and how close, you know, directors always want to have a close-up of a tongue being bitten out, and producers who are much more prudent souls want it in a long shot, and we ended up compromising. But one thing we were certain of was that when it happened, the audience would dive under their seats, and when they came back up again, the transition had been made and they understood exactly why he was now in a loony bin. And I went to see the film, and it was actually in Times Square at its opening, and this scene came up, and instead of diving behind their seats, they actually got up and started cheering. And at that point, I realised I knew nothing about audiences and reactions. And it really had an extraordinary effect on me. And I think The Chariots of Fire, to a very great extent, was a reaction to that moment. I set about to make a film that couldn't possibly generate that type of reaction. And I became much more careful. I mean, interestingly enough, I then went on a few years later to make The Killing Fields, which has moments of violence in it. But no one ever depicted The Killing Fields as being a violent film. And I don't remember anyone remotely enjoying or glorifying in any of the violence in The Killing Fields. So I did learn a lesson.
Now, when you were given the job as the head of Columbia Pictures, was this before or after you had your Midnight Express revelation?
Oh, much, way after. I did Midnight Express in 77, it came out in 78, and I went to Columbia in 86.
What were they thinking?
I've never found out. I mean, I was headhunted, I was cajoled, I was persuaded. I put in all the health warnings you could imagine that probably I was the wrong person, and they'd absolutely convinced themselves I was the right person.
And they decided, after I think about 18 months, that in fact you were the wrong person.
Well, yes, but the interesting thing is, you know, I've had to deal with this a lot over the years. I never, ever, at any point, was fired. What happened was that Coca-Cola sold 51% of the company. My contract required that I could only work for a wholly owned subsidiary of Coca-Cola, because I was very conscious going in that the only reason I wanted to do this job is because I liked the stability of a Coca-Cola owning it. So the day they sold it, my contract was in breach, and I got a phone call from my lawyer in New York who said, do you want to leave? I said, I'd love to. He said, well, you can. They just breached your contract. And they were very honourable. I must say, they contractually, they behaved well, and I was extremely pleased to come home.
You had a reputation when you were running Columbia for being opposed to the star system, in which stars got enormously high salaries and could make a lot of demands in their contract. What were some of your problems with the star system as it existed when you were the head of Columbia Pictures?
Three problems. One is making a movie is a very difficult operation, and it requires an incredible degree of collegiality. And if you allow yourself to be flim-flammed by a star into making that human being on the set among colleagues so special that everyone else feels second class, you do not create collegiality, and it shows in the movie. And I have any number of experiences over the years whereby you just can't work that way. You know, the star who sits in a dressing room until the very last minute and then emerges onto set, what she actually does without knowing it is undermines everyone else on the movie, because everyone feels that they're not part of a collegiate attempt to make something wonderful. And the purpose of a producer is to get every single person involved in the making of a film to think they're special, and that this movie is special, and that everything they're doing is special. And that works by creating teamwork. So first of all, the star system per se, if you allow a star to behave badly, cuts up against teamwork and hurts the movie. Secondly, the more a star gets, you know, on a movie, the less you have to spend on the screen. The thing I'm most proud of is the fact that in the case of The Killing Fields, which costs $14.4 million, I think, from memory, dollars, 90% of those costs are actually on the screen. Only 10% was spent on things other than what you're looking at. And now that's vital, again, to create a good cinema. The more the stars get, the higher the cost of the movie, the less instinct there is among studios to take any risks, so that your story gets safer. Your marketing gets safer. Everything becomes safer. Lastly, and most importantly, and this is not the star's fault, some lunatic, and no one's ever put up their hand and admitted who it was, some lunatic in Hollywood in the early 80s, instead of making deals like we used to make, which was a star got a percentage of the movie, but they got their salary against that percentage, someone, in a moment of panic, gave a star a salary, let's say $5 million, plus a percentage of the gross. The day that happened, the whole thing went haywire, because it meant that the star could make a hell of a lot of money and the movie could go straight down the toilet. Now, that's inequitable, because what we need is healthy, profitable studios who consistently are able to make films. So the idea that the talent base takes money out and therefore depletes the amount of money available for investment is long-term stupidity.
My guest is film producer David Putnam. His new movie is called My Life So Far. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Putnam. He's a film producer who now is a member of England's House of Lords. I want to ask you about a couple of movies that you produced that were failures at the box office, and get your impression of what went wrong. Housekeeping, which was more of an art film, really, made by the same director who did, I'm blanking out on the title, Local Hero.
Local Hero with me, yeah.
Yeah, Leonard Part 6, which was a big film with Bill Cosby as the star, was also a failure. The Old Gringo, which had Gregory Peck and Jane Fonda. How can you forget Jane Fonda's name, right? And it was based on a novel by Carlos Fuentes.
That's right.
Okay, so you have Housekeeping, a small film, Leonard Part 6, big commercial film, Bill Cosby, and The Old Gringo, you know, based on a literary novel, all failures, all failed for different reasons. What went wrong? Were you happy with the films, or do you just think that the audience missed out on an opportunity?
Oh, I loved, let's go through them. I loved Housekeeping. I thought then, and I think today, it's a beautiful film. It was very slight. I think it was marketed very badly, and I was around at the time, so I've got to take partial responsibility for that. But it's a beautiful film with a lot to say and a lot of value. And it's a jewel. Anyone that is lucky enough to stumble across a copy and looks at it on video today will see a film that's one of those very, very slight, very rare film with beautiful performances. So Housekeeping, I've got no apology for at all, other than the fact that I wish we'd done a better job selling it. In the case of Leonard Part 6, it was a stupid film to have made. It was made, it's a vanity film. It was a classic film made to work with and please a star. That star was someone with very, very close relationships with Coca-Cola. And in a sane and proper world, it shouldn't have been made, but it got made. The case of the third one, The Old Gringo.
Just to translate, Bill Cosby, who starred in Leonard Part Six was in a lot of Coke ads at the time. Is that right? Or Coke product?
No, he was no. Bill at the time, and maybe still does, owned a couple of bottling franchises.
I see.
With Coca-Cola. Okay. Now, what I'm saying is, it oughtn't have been made. Mm-hmm. And I guess either I should have had the sense just to stop it, although that would have caused enormous events, mm-hmm. or Bill should have had the sense to look at it and say, this is a pile of shit, and I shouldn't be making this film. Or Coca-Cola should have said, much as it means upsetting one of our most valued customers and friends, we shouldn't, this film should, there were just, everyone got paralysed, and the film kind of, as it were, made itself and snuck through the middle. It's a dreadful film. It has no redeeming quality whatsoever, unlike Housekeeping. Now, Old Gringo is a much more interesting case. One of the best scripts I've ever read in my life, a magnificent script by a woman called Aida Bortnick, a passionate producer in Jane Fonda. She could not have worked harder or been more professional or done a better job. She was a terrific colleague to work with. I think a very nice piece of casting of Gregory Peck. And a director that had in the past previously made a couple of very good films, but who the film was just too big for. I've had this experience before. It's not the only time. And who just sadly lost the plot. The film just doesn't quite work, but the script was beautiful. The performances were nice. There's a magnificent scene, particularly one brilliant scene, Gregory Peck talking about being old. Wonderful moments in the film, but a director who just couldn't handle, I think, that scale of film. A talented man, no question about that. But the film was just too big for him.
Obviously, you feel very strong that movies should have a basis in community morality. And I'm wondering now, you know, in the United States, big debate now about violence in the movies, what should be done. If you were the movie czar in the United States, what would you do?
Jack Valenti, who is a friend of mine, a very nice man indeed, and every other sane person making movies knows that movies have an enormous social impact. It is naive and silly to pretend that they don't. The idea that some or other, the gun lobby and the movie lobby, have managed to, as it were, escape public wrath by just blaming each other is a joke. There is no question there is a relationship between guns and violence, and there's equally no question that there's a relationship between uncaring, unthinking, irresponsible filmmaking and the tone of the society in which those films get distributed. To pretend otherwise is farcical.
So what would you do?
What I'd do, I'd bang all their heads together. I'd impose very, very strict gun laws tomorrow morning. I'd never. You've got to understand.
Gun laws in movies or in life?
No, gun laws in both. The idea you've got to do one or the other is a nonsense. You impose very strict gun control, and then you set about banging filmmakers' heads together and making sure that they are also become part of some kind of social consensus about the nature of the nation that you want to live in. You do not want to live in a nation that kills each other. You do not want to live in a nation that's, as it were, successful only by climbing over the bodies of the people it's been able to beat up and beat. America, one of the most fascinating things about the United States, and I love the United States, is that what it represents to the rest of the world in terms of freedom and fairness and decency, which is the America I was brought up with, is no longer visible. It's visible on the ground. If I go and live in my little cottage in Utah, people are wonderful. Individuals in the States are absolutely wonderful. But unfortunately, that is not reflected in the media and certainly isn't reflected by this insane obsession with firearms.
So you'd bang heads of filmmakers, but would you write regulations that would limit the content of films? Would you want people carded before they go into movies? Change the rating system? And are there concrete things that you would want to change?
I would love to hear every filmmaker explain what sort of society they wish to live in and what they've done in the past 12 months to contribute to that society. And once you begin there, when filmmakers are forced to actually explain themselves in terms of what are they doing, what do they think they're doing, what do they think the power of film is. It's a process of evasion, Terry. What we've allowed to happen is this kind of ingenuous sense that really films are just entertainment. They're not really anything to do with society. You know, just like guns are really only about popping off at targets, at target practice. These are serious societal issues. And unless the American society gets a grip of both issues, not one or the other, both issues, the American society's got some very difficult questions to ask itself for the next 20 years.
Did you sit down with the filmmakers you worked with when you were the head of Columbia and have these kinds of talks with them and ask them to explain their view of morality and their hopes for the future and for young people, et cetera?
I try very hard not to use the word morality because I think it's a misused word. Ethics, yes. I tried to create an ethical basis for everything we ever did there. And I think that, again, anyone in the communication world, including yourself, that lives their life out without asking themselves those questions is potentially doing a massive disservice to society. And I'm not a right winger. I should mention here, I'm a socialist. I work at the left of centre. I work at left of centre party here in the House of Lords, and I am a total pluralist. But I equally know what irresponsibility is when I see it.
Are there any movies that you really love because they speak to your dark side that you don't think are the kind of like ethical films that you would in theory support, but you recognize that they're a real masterpiece of filmmaking and that they move you?
Two films immediately come to mind, both by Bertolucci. One is the film 1900, which had some terrible things in it, terrible moments in it, but I thought was a most extraordinary piece of work. And the other, which says more about me than about the movie probably, is The Last Tango in Paris. I remember being absolutely fascinated by it. I mean, I'm really picking up just on your question about what did it do to my dark side? What it did is maybe allowed me to believe I had a dark side. Although, let's end on a lighter note. When I was a kid watching Tom Jones, I think I was about 18 when Tom Jones came out, 19. I remember sitting there. Do you remember the eating scene in Tom Jones?
No, I don't actually.
It's a very, very erotic eating scene where Tom Jones and this woman he's met are eating their meal and looking at each other and the food's falling out their plate. And I remember sitting there thinking, there's got to be something wrong with me. I think this is really horny. But I'm looking around. Why? No one else in the audience seemed to be thinking this. And I actually got quite troubled by the the nature of my imagination. Only years later did I discover that every single person sitting in that cinema was having exactly the same crisis.
Okay. Well, David Putnam, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
David Putnam, he produced the new film My Life So Far, which he says is likely to be his final film. This is Fresh Air.